This is the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 13th, 2016. Current federal tax developments, as always, is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. And this week, we're going to start looking at some interesting things coming up. We're going to take a look at the fact the IRS got the online transcript program back up and running. The IRS also has some bad news for developers this week. Certain real estate developers will have some news they don't like. We have finalized regulations on cancellation of debt and disregarded entities and grantor trusts that the IRS had released in proposed forms back in 2011. We'll have a case of opinion shopping that costs the holder of a life insurance policy an awful lot in penalties. And finally, the IRS issues the Certified Professional Employer Organization application process rules. And so any of your clients who may be thinking about going that way now have the ability to start working on those applications. Current federal tax developments is brought to you, as always, by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE. This is the time of year we start working with all this neat stuff. And in fact, what's coming up now is we've got a few upcoming updates for you, because now's the time to catch back up on all those things you might have missed while you were busy. First thing, ANA's had a lot going on this year. And in New Jersey, Jennifer Elder is going to be presenting in Jamesburg on June the 30th with an accounting and auditing comprehensive annual review. For those of you who may not be aware, I know sometimes those of us who do tax and accounting, we have a little tendency to pay a lot of attention on the tax side. And if we have small clients, we kind of avoid the accounting side. But there are a couple of significant new accounting standards updates that you need to discuss that are going to come into play over the next couple of years, specifically in revenue recognition and a little bit further out, looking at the lease changes that have been made. They're both very significant and certainly can foul up loan covenants. So you probably want to stop by and take a look at that course if you haven't had an update recently, or even if you have, you know, good to go over and review this. I'll be doing a current federal tax developments, essentially this for a full day, where we'll get to ask questions and interact on July the 7th in the Seattle, Washington area, actually in Bellevue. And I'll also be doing an advanced tax update for experienced practitioners, which will take a look at these update issues again, but this time for a practitioner who's been in practice for a longer period of time, on July the 21st in Roseland, New Jersey. You can find the registration information for all of those courses on the applicable state society courses, the New Jersey Society of CPAs or the Washington Society of CPAs. So be sure to check in and look at those courses and the other courses being offered to you by your state society of CPAs, because now is the time to get yourself back in position to start working on what you need to catch up for this year. Now we're going to go ahead and start looking into our cases for this week. And specifically, we have an IRS issued a new revenue ruling. This revenue ruling is Revenue Ruling 2016-15. It was issued on June the 10th. And this is going to talk about whether people who have real property can qualify for Section 108 exclusion. This is Revenue Ruling 2016-15. The IRS, under this revenue ruling, took a look at two different situations for real estate developers. And what they looked at here is the question. We're looking at whether, in fact, somebody can have qualified real property indebtedness if we're a real estate developer. And the IRS posed two particular cases here. In the first situation, the IRS looked at a developer who was developing a piece of property, but they were developing it to build an apartment complex. And when everything was said and done, they were going to own the complex and go ahead and lease that property to tenants. In that case, the IRS said that qualifies for the qualified real property indebtedness exclusion. For those who do not remember, that exclusion allows you, if you have cancellation of debt related to real property using a trade or business and you're not a C corporation, you can electively choose to exclude that cancellation of debt from your income and reduce the basis of depreciable real property that you hold. So the IRS had no problem in that case. But they had a problem in the second case. In the second case, we're looking at a developer where a developer was not going to, now he's going to build this project, but instead of selling it, treating it as an apartment complex, let's say now we're going to go ahead, we develop the property, and then we're going to sell parts of that property out to various customers. So we're selling the property now. Instead of holding on to the building, we're going ahead and selling it out, maybe selling it out as an office condo, maybe selling it out as, maybe they were separate homes, but we're going to go ahead and sell the property. In that case, the IRS took the position that that does not qualify for qualified real property indebtedness, despite the fact you borrowed money. You may be building exactly the same building as the property that's being used by the developer who's going to rent to other parties. But because you're doing that for sale, that's inventory. And the IRS concludes that Congress's intent here was to recover, to allow you to basically not recognize income today, but pick up that income over time, over the life of the property. The IRS points out that since we'd have to reduce the basis of depreciable real estate, we wouldn't reduce the basis of that inventoried real estate. So we'd sell the inventoried real estate probably at a loss, but we'd recover the difference only on our depreciable real estate, and we could very well hit the caps on that. And we'll recover that over the term of that, which would be, 39 years commercial real estate. The IRS said, well, that's clearly not what Congress intended. Okay, all well and good, except that the IRS had this old revenue ruling, 7686. 7686 said that if you had a merchant who acquired merchandise and had that secured by a debt, and then later that debt was reduced or renegotiated downward, or parts of it were simply forgiven, that the merchant did not have cancellation of debt income. Well, that seems to be exactly what's going on here with the developer who's selling the property to customers. So the question becomes, well, doesn't that ruling go ahead and say we really don't care if it's qualified real property? IRS said, well, the laws changed dramatically since 1976 in Section 108 and Section 1017, the two sections that apply here. Because of that, the IRS position is, really, we shouldn't have any more. That ruling is no longer good law. And despite the fact we've never actually pulled the ruling, it actually hasn't applied for years. So we're now going to go ahead and basically declare that ruling obsolete as part of this ruling. Next up, you probably all heard this week, the IRS now has gone back, and we're going to turn back on for the IRS, for at least for some taxpayers, the online transcript program. So the online transcript program will now be used. This is news release 2016-85, issued on June the 7th. As you may remember, the online transcript program, just about a year ago, the IRS had discovered there was unauthorized access there. People weren't the taxpayers, had gotten in. And by the time the dust settled, we discovered that it was well over 700,000 taxpayers who had their information accessed under that system. The IRS, of course, shut down that system a year ago and told us that they were working on trying to come up with a new system that would enable taxpayers to be able to be more secure so they wouldn't open up the system to people who weren't the taxpayer. One interesting aside, though, which the IRS had mentioned, and we mentioned here a few weeks back, is that the IRS noted that under the old program, which, by the way, the crooks were getting in under, a lot of taxpayers still couldn't figure out how to get in. So they couldn't answer the questions, but the crooks could. Well, unfortunately, to tighten up the system, we're going to have to actually make it even more difficult now. So what's going to happen here is the IRS is going to have even more detailed out-of-wallet questions. They won't ask you things anymore like what was an address you used to live at, because, hey, you can find that online. Rather, they're going to ask a lot more detailed information, plus a couple of key things you'll need. You will have to have an account number for a debt. There's a specific list of debt in the fact sheets that they issued with this notice that is described, and you'll find information on that on the current Federal Tax Developments website, if you either go to the article on this or download this week's PDF. And the other issue is you have to have a postpaid cell phone. Now, a postpaid cell phone is a cell phone that is with generally one of the four carriers and for which you have had a credit check run to get you in there. Remember, postpaid is you have an account, let's say, with Verizon, and Verizon bills you at the end of the month, technically, for the service for the prior month. That's a postpaid cell phone. Prepaid cell phones, where they don't actually verify that information because you have to pay them in advance or you don't get to use it for the following month, those phones won't work, nor will any sort of phone number that is created online, something like a Google Voice number. So this means specifically that any prepaid service from an MVNO or any, which would be, a lot of those services like Cricket, Virgin Mobile, those are all basically the vendors who resell services from the Big Four or any of the Big Four's own postpaid services, which they all have, or things like Google's Project Fi, none of those will count. Which means if you either don't have a cell phone, and actually there still are people who don't have one, or your cell phone is with one of those postpaid services, which actually is happening a lot more today, not because any more people are, you know, are bad credit, but because since we no longer have subsidized phones for the most part when buying, a lot of people have noticed that those options are cheaper. And their theory is, well, why should I pay extra to Verizon, or why should I pay extra to T-Mobile when I could go, let's say, buy with Project Fi and be able to get my phone for a lot cheaper per month, or go with one of the others, you know, Metro PCS, any of those ones that offer the postpaid service. Well, if your client has that type of service, they've economized that way, they can't use the online program. What that means is, without question, some taxpayers are simply not going to be able to access the online electronic transcript program, either because they simply can't answer the questions, and that's going to be a case for a lot of taxpayers, or they simply don't meet the required qualifications, because you have to be able to qualify for this in order to, you have to have one of those qualifications to make this work. Next up, let's go to Treasury Decision 9771 that was issued on June 10th. This is the IRS making final regulations that they had issued, proposed regulations back in 2011. Under Section 108 of the Internal Revenue Code, we have exclusions that are available to taxpayers if they have a debt discharge when they are insolvent or when they are in bankruptcy. Now, Section 108 had specific rules that says if a partnership does this, we do not test at the partnership level for insolvency or bankruptcy, but we test at the individual partner level. Some people had decided, well, you know, the regs didn't say anything, the law didn't say anything about a disregarded entity. So, you know, maybe a disregarded entity, if we have an LLC that holds a piece of real estate and it has a mortgage in it that's recourse, and we end up, you know, giving up that piece of property, well, you know, the LLC is insolvent because it's liable on there. We may have guaranteed it, but it's liable on it. So since that was an insolvent disregarded entity, then we should be able to not have to pay tax on the cancellation of debt if the creditor doesn't come after any other assets. The IRS said, not so fast, guys. They said in this case, with a disregarded entity or a grantor trust, that the test is applied at the deemed owner's level. So the deemed owner either has to be insolvent or the deemed owner has to be in bankruptcy. And that second one's kind of interesting because what the IRS did earlier this year, we told you about an action on decision where the IRS disagreed with four tax court cases from a number of years back, where the tax court had said that if somebody had a debt discharge at a partnership that filed bankruptcy, but the court in the bankruptcy case issued a discharge to the individual partners who had not filed bankruptcy. The IRS disagrees with that case. These regulations very explicitly now take that point. The taxpayer in question must file a Title 11 action as a bankruptcy action. We cannot have, you know, if the action is only filed by the single member LLC or only filed by any other sort of entity like a business trust, that's not going to qualify the entity or the, that's not going to qualify us for the bankruptcy exclusion under Section 108. The IRS now believes that that would be inappropriate, is their term, to do it that way. Next up, we have a case of, you know, sometimes your clients just don't like the answers you give them. And that was what was occurred in the case of Mallory versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-110 issued on June the 6th. The taxpayer had years ago bought a life insurance policy, single premium. Over time, they had taken money out of this policy and had taken money out significantly in excess of what they put into the policy. Well, eventually they get a note from the insurance company. The insurance company says, owner of the policy, we have a little problem. Your policy is running out of cash value. And if you don't give us over $20,000 within the next, you know, couple of months, your policy will lapse. And when it does so, the amount that's going to be considered income to you will be the total balance of the loan, including accrued interest, reduced by what you paid in premiums. which is going to be a very substantial gain, and you should be aware of that happening. Well, the taxpayer didn't pay the $20,000. That's not surprising. And also not surprising, you know, they then, you know, wondered about what the tax consequences were. The taxpayer, in this case, the wife, went to see their regular tax preparer, which was at Liberty Tax Services. So, you know, basically a storefront tax operation. And the preparer there told them, very straightforward, preparer they'd used for years, said, there's going to be lots of tax due on this transaction. You're going to owe the big bucks. Obviously, the taxpayers weren't thrilled with that answer. So what they started doing, they got that answer. So remember, the insurance company told them they'd have this big amount of taxable income. The tax preparer, who they paid, told them they had tons of income and would owe tons of tax. Well, they started calling other tax preparers. Of course, they didn't offer to pay these people for their opinion, you understand. They just called other preparers in the area. And they kept asking them about whether or not this was a taxable transaction. I don't know about you, but if you get a if I get a random call during tax season where somebody asks me if something's a taxable transaction and wants free tax advice, I'm probably not going to spend a whole lot of time on the phone with them. I'm probably going to tell them either hire me or forget it. Well, they also called the IRS because, of course, we all know that that works well to get answers. The IRS also said on the phone that, you know, they couldn't give them an answer right away. Well, they didn't file their tax return timely. Apparently, they didn't like that return that showed a balance due. Eventually, they did file the return late, but they didn't report this income. The taxpayer did attach a note to the return that said, we're just not sure what that income would be. Nobody could give us the right answer, and please send us a corrected return. Well, as you may guess, eventually, under the CP2000 notice, they got a corrected notice, and they didn't like that one either. That's how we end up back in tax court. Not surprisingly, the tax court found that this is a taxable transaction. As the insurance company told them, as their preparer told them, it's taxable. So the only real question was, could they get out of the penalty? You know, the automatic 20% penalty that applies, accuracy-related penalty under 6226, that applies when you understate your income, understate your tax by more than $5,000 or 10% of the amount due, and they were way past those limits. Well, they said, look, you know, we went and we talked to all these people to try to get an answer and nobody gave us an answer. And so, you know, we shouldn't be held liable for this. Rather, we should be able to get out of the penalty. Tax court said, not so fast, guys. You had two people you paid, the insurance company and your tax preparer, both told you it was taxable. You then went and tried to get free advice from everywhere else, and none of them said it wasn't. They just said they didn't have enough information yet to tell you if it was. You did not do what you reasonably should have done to properly prepare your return. You had information it was taxable. You had a 1099-R that said it was taxable. We don't care about all these phone calls you made to random preparers around your area. That doesn't count. You know, you're going to be held the fact that you knew from the preparer who you paid that this was taxable. You had a 1099 that said it was taxable. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, basically you're stuck with this at this point. Okay. Little problem, little issue. Taxpayers may not like the answer. Quite often they don't, but it was one of those they had to live with. Finally, let's talk about the Revenue Procedure 2016-33. This was issued here on June the 3rd. This outlines the formal procedures that are put in place for an organization that wishes to become a Certified Professional Employer Organization, CPEO. This was added back in 2014 by the Congress. And what it allows us to do is deals with a problem that we've had. The issue became, if you use a payroll service or a professional employer organization as an employer, well, that's fine. You know, you give them money, they make the payroll tax deposits. But what happens if they don't? Well, the problem we had, and we had some cases, some really bad ones, Citywide Transit Inc. versus Commissioner in the Second Circuit was a really awful case, where the taxpayers get stuck with having to, you know, pay that tax. And they have to pay it going back. Citywide Transit, even, they decided since the 941s in question had been basically dummied up by their payroll service guy to fraudulently, because he was pocketing the money, That was a fraudulent return, and they were basically on the hook for every and all years, including closed what would normally be closed years. That was a really bad result case. So to get around these bad fact cases where, you know, the payroll service walked off with the money, Congress decided we would start this certified professional employer organization system. The CPEO system would allow us to transfer that liability if we meet certain requirements. So what we have now is, though, to become this. Now, the IRS a year ago was supposed to get this started, but they didn't have time. They couldn't get the program together. So while they were supposed to start taking applications July of 2015, and the program was supposed to start running January of 16, everything got pushed back a year. So now we're coming up on the July of 16 date, and we now have, in this revenue procedure, 2016-33, we now have the actual steps that will be involved. This revenue procedure contains requirements for an online application. What will be very important to those people, if you have clients who wish to offer this service, there are significant A&A issues for accounting and auditing, because it is going to require an audited financial statement from the CPA, and the CPA will also have to opine on two other issues. So when we get into this thing, because the CPA would have to basically make certain statements. One of the key things is the CPA will sign a letter to the IRS stating that they are currently independent of the CPEO under the AICPA standards. That's the test the IRS will use for now. That they're not currently under suspension or disbarment from practice before the IRS, that they're duly qualified to practice in at least one state, and they'll file a written declaration that they qualify as a CPA, and they will basically file a power of attorney form to represent this entity before the IRS on this matter. Now, the financial statement opinions, the opinion the CPA has to give has to be not just a clean, it's got to be a clean opinion on the financial statements, but they also have to say that the financial statements reflect positive working capital, or they meet one of the exceptions that allows temporary negative working capital. And they have to also state that the certified professional employer organization computes its taxable income on the accrual basis of accounting. Now, these are all issues, therefore, that you're you know, other people or those in your organization who do this sort of work are going to have to check this out and make this work with their own professional requirements. Finally, it also tells us about the interim information that will have to be given by this these organizations, because there's various quarterly interim reportings along with quarterly reports the CPA will have to attach with the return. Again, it is an A&A issue. One thing to remind you guys of, remember, A&A, this is an audit report, and you know, audit and attest level reports. In most states, that means if you offer this service to a client, you're going to also be triggering a required peer review in most cases. So be aware of what's going on, and you want to be aware of how you're going to handle this. Now, with that, let's remind you that, you know, as we said earlier, this is the time of year you got to start doing stuff. Work is starting now. So your state society of CPAs is going to be offering you the option to go ahead and, you know, sign up for your courses. We've already mentioned that. Check with your state society of CPAs for all the courses they're offering to you, for live courses and other mechanisms they may offer. This is the time of year. Remember, the idea of continuing education is to gain the skills you're going to need to do the work that you will give value to the clients, and which, by the way, pays your bills. So be sure that you've got that stuff together. This has been the current federal tax developments here for the week of June the 13th, 2016. Now, you can catch our updates during the week on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF with the articles with all of today's items we've discussed, so you can read those at your leisure. Send any questions or comments you have about this broadcast to edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at edzollers. I look forward to having you guys back in a week when we'll take a look at what comes up in the coming weeks here in the area of taxes. And be sure to follow the website in the interim.